Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studio of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, May 25th, 2017. I'd like to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down the names, addresses, emails, web pages, phone numbers, whatever information you need to take action for the environment. And let's start with announcements. And yesterday was a day in remembrance of Judy Berry in this story from the Earth First Journal as found on their newswire. Today, May 24th, marks the 27th anniversary of the bomb attack against Earth First organizer Judy Berry and partner Daryl Cherney. While the two are in Oakland on a musical organizing tour for Redwood Summer in 1990, a bomb planted under Judy's seat in their car was detonated. The pair were soon arrested, and while in critical condition with a fractured pelvis, she was charged with transporting explosives. Due to the immediate presence and accusations of the FBI's bomb team, it is widely speculated that the FBI had a part in the plot to assassinate and/or frame her. Charges were finally dropped against her due to lack of evidence, and Daryl Cherney was awarded years later in a suit against the FBI for violating their civil rights. Judy Berry was an incredibly influential and effective environmental activist, labor organizer, and feminist, responsible for, among many other admirable actions, allying the IWW with Earth First and for organizing the Redwood Summer of 1990. She was also a talented musician and writer, and used these tools to further the cause of revolutionary ecology. Earth First and the other wider radical environmental movement, we owe much to her efforts. While Judy was seriously injured in the blast, she continued to fight and struggle before dying of cancer in 1997. With love and infinite admiration and respect, we remember a warrior that did so much to help the planet and our movement and continues to inspire our work. And with rage, we note that the depths to which the FBI will go to repress and attack us, and the deep fear the agents of oppression have for our organizing when it's at its best. And in Montreal, a logging company office has been occupied in this story from Submedia as found on the Earth First Newswire. This morning, a group of autonomous environmentalists in Montreal occupied the offices of Eacom Timber in opposition to the company's plan to log forest in the habitat of endangered caribou in northern Quebec. In order to facilitate the logging operation, the government of Quebec plans to displace the entire herd of caribou into a zoo, a move that has been opposed by the Assembly of First Nations of Quebec and Labrador. The company is currently constructing a road into the zone that they hope to log, and the activists say the fight is far from over. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for today. It has been a busy week here in the Buffalo Field Campaign as we wind down our field season but prepare to celebrate the honor of being in the field with the Buffalo for 20 years. Board members, former volunteers, and supporters are beginning to arrive to join us for our anniversary party tomorrow, Friday the 26th, 2017, while others are simultaneously preparing to migrate to the Four Directions for the summer. Even so, we remain engaged in the field with the Buffalo. Many of our new volunteers who arrived after their field season in Gardner came to a close have been asking what it's like up there, and as they are all committed to returning next season, we took them on a short field trip to the Gardner Basin. While there, we checked on the 59 bulls who remain captive inside Yellowstone's trap awaiting the park's decision on their 50-year quarantine domestication proposal, which the Buffalo Field Campaign strongly opposes. Volunteers were shocked by the industrial construction of Yellowstone's Stevens Creek Buffalo Trap, as well as the excessive closure around it, and were doubly outraged to see the other imprisoned buffalo in USDA Animal and Plant Health Inspection Services pastures, where just a few miles north of the Yellowstone's boundary, buffalo are being experimented on with a chemical pesticide birth control agent, Gonicon. We prayed for these relatives and strengthened our resolve to end these cruel and unnecessary practices. And as we made our way back through Yellowstone towards campaign headquarters, the wild reached out and touched us in the form of marmot, elk, pronghorn, buffalo, and grizzly bear, shouting, "Still here! We're still here, reminding us of who and what we will continue to fight for. We also perform one of our many community services, picking up litter left by careless travelers along our 2.5-mile stretch of Adopt-a-Highway on Highway 20. As volunteers freed this stretch from plastic bags, beer bottles, and other trash, the Montana Department of Livestock was busy trying to push buffalo off of hobby rancher Pat Pova's land. Once again, the buffalo left the Department of Livestock in the dust, spotting the rider from afar and bolting for the thick woods. For the third time in a row, the buffalo escaped the threat, and Bridger spent the next few hours searching for them. After getting lost during the last haze, this time Bridger had GPS assistance, adding a bit more amusement to another foiled attempt. Eventually, though, he found the buffalo, but they refused to move. The game warden was called out to assist, as well as other Montana Department of Livestock employee. They fired cracker rounds, and still the buffalo resisted. After some time, the buffalo decided they'd had enough of this nonsense, got up and bolted. 22 big brown buffalo and 5 wee calves ran through the forest, chased by the Montana Department of Livestock agents. They were pursued over extremely thick deadfall, which is difficult enough for adult buffalo to handle, but terribly hard for the little calves to navigate. After a short while, the buffalo reached the edge of the Madison River, where they crossed north over the bluffs, part of the safety zone for their new year-round habitat. Exhausted and hungry, they remained there for the rest of the day. As all this was taking place, Buffalo Field Campaign's co-founder Michael Meese was representing wild buffalo all the way over in Switzerland, where he had been invited to speak at NONAM, the Nordamerica Native Museum. In Europe, there is a profound love for wild buffalo and indigenous cultures. Mike was well received and surrounded by people who are passionately committed to helping from afar, and met a few folks who will be traveling here to volunteer, and they want to bring him back to speak to at least 10 universities and participate in an indigenous film festival. This is yet another example of how the wild buffalo of this country are beloved around the world, and that this is not a Montana issue, as the state likes to insist, but an issue of global concern. The whole world is watching. To protect rhinos, a national park in Africa just shoots people. 50 poachers have been killed so far in this story by Elizabeth from Bored Panda, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Kasirwanga National Park is a story of success when it comes to conservation of rhinos, but what they've done to achieve it is allowing its workers to shoot and even kill potential poachers. So far, the park has killed 50 people. Rhinos are safe here. A century ago, there were only a handful of Indian one-horned rhinoceros. Now the park hosts more than 2,400, which is two-thirds of the world's population. However, little is talked about the fact that in 2015, more people were shot dead by park guards than the number of rhinos killed by poachers. These people all went after rhino horn, as they could be sold for as much as $6,000 for 100 grams, or $60,000 for a kilogram, or $30,000 a pound, which is considerably more expensive than gold. They are mostly marketed as a miracle cure for everything from cancer to erectile dysfunction. So yes, rhinos do need protection, but this has gone a little far. National park workers can kill a person and get away with impunity. The question is, could this kind of punishment ever be justified, and how many innocent people were killed? We just don't know. There's no information in this story. And sharks have been freed by Animal Liberation Front in Mexico in this story received anonymously at the Bite Back magazine, as found on the Earth First Newswire. On May 4th, 4 cat sharks living in captivity at Playa Tiburon, Isla Mujeres, also known as Quintana Roo, Mexico, were released anonymously at dawn. Until all the cages are empty, Animal Liberation Front, Mexico. And groups seek to protect the imperiled vaquita porpoises through a United States ban on imports of Mexican seafood caught with dangerous nets. Conservation groups petitioned the U.S. National Marine Wild Fisheries Service today to ban imports of seafood caught with gill nets in Mexico's upper Gulf of California in order to save the critically endangered vaquita porpoise. The vaquita population has declined by 90% over the past 5 years, with fewer than 30 of the small porpoise left on the planet. Entanglement in gill nets is the sole threat to the species' survival, with scientists predicting that the vaquita will be extinct in 2 years if fishing practices remain unchanged. We can't leave any tool unused that will help us get the vaquita's killer gill nets out of their habitat, said Zach Smith, senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council's Marine Mammal Protection Project. The fishing industry is driving the vaquita's extinction, and pressure on that group to fix their practices may be the most important way to save the porpoises. The United States must immediately ban the import of any seafood from Mexico that is contributing to the vaquita's extinction. Mexico has failed to permanently ban all gill nets in the vaquita's habitat, despite repeated recommendation by scientists and the evidence that the use of gill nets by any fishery in or adjacent to the vaquita's range will undeniably lead to the species' extinction. It is horrific to watch the vaquita vanish from the earth in real time, said Sarah Ulleman, International Program Director for the Center of Biological Diversity. Only strong actions like trade sanctions will force Mexican government to finally step in and save these amazing little animals. The U.S. Marine Mammal Protection Act requires the U.S. government to ban seafood imports from fisheries that kill marine mammals like the vaquita in excess of U.S. standards for marine mammal bycatch, that is, the accidental entanglement and deaths of marine mammals in fishing gear. If U.S. standards were applied to Mexican fishermen operating in or near the vaquita's habitat, fishermen would be prohibited from contributing to the bycatch of any vaquita because it is gravely endangered and losing its population at a rate of 50% per year. We can't continue to wait for Mexico to find the political will and courage to save the vaquita in the wild as the species declines toward extinction, said D.J. Schubert, wildlife biologist with the Animal Welfare Institute. It's time for the U.S. to step up and use its laws to compel the Mexican government to save the species or suffer the consequences of a ban on certain seafood exports. And Sea Shepherd Conservation Society ships have arrived in Costa Rica with an offer to help curb illegal fishing activities around Cocos Island. Conservation Group supplies the vessel crew and more to Island Park Rangers. Rangers on Cocos Islands need a fast patrol vessel, and Sea Shepherd can supply that need. Sea Shepherd arrives in Costa Rica today with an offer to assist the Central American country in controlling illegal fishing in the waters surrounding the Cocos Island National Park. The nonprofit Anti-Poaching Conservation Society has offered to deploy the motor vessel John Paul de Joria, a 110-foot island-class former U.S. Coast Guard patrol boat, to Cocos Island for use by its park rangers. This offer, part of Sea Shepherd's Operation Treasured Islands campaign, also comes with a supply of a Sea Shepherd crew, fuel, and provisions, as well as giving Costa Rican rangers command of operations to patrol and protect the Cocos Island Marine Reserve. Cocos Island, some 300 miles off the coast of Costa Rica, is home to many large marine species, such as hammerhead sharks, rays, and dolphins. This makes it a popular destination for scuba divers, but at the same time attracts illegal poachers, particularly those involved in the shark fin trade. And Australia's Information Commission agrees Australians have every right to see the 2008 customs whaling footage in this story from the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society Australia. In working with the great people at the Environmental Defenders Office of New South Wales, after many years of fighting for transparency, we are happy to announce that the Information Commissioner has decided that Australians have every right to see the 2008 publicly funded customs whaling footage. Back in 2008, as part of Australia's whaling case against Japan in the International Court of Justice, the Australian customs vessel Oceanic Viking filmed Japan's whaling fleet chasing, harpooning, and murdering whales inside the Australian Whale Sanctuary off the Antarctic coast. This was during the Rudd-Gillard Labor government, and the evidence obtained was used in the International Court of Justice case that led to the ruling on the 31st of March of 2014 that Japan's whaling program was not scientific. EDO New South Wales Sea Shepherd's solicitors welcomed the Information Commissioner's decision. CEO Sue Higginson says, "This is a significant win for transparency and accountability about how the Australian government has dealt with Japanese whaling in the Australian Whale Sanctuary in Antarctica. The whales are protected from harm under Australian law, so any evidence showing harm is a matter of significant public interest. We first sought access to the Australian government's footage of Japanese whaling in the Australian Whale Sanctuary in March of 2012, so it has been a large, long, and arduous process. Over the past 5 years, the Australian government has refused access on the basis that releasing of the whaling footage would harm its relations with Japan, this despite challenging Japan's whaling program in the International Court of Justice and many government ministers over the years publicly condemning the program. Now the Information Commissioner has found that such an argument cannot be sustained and has ordered the release of the footage. The Australian government has 28 days to appeal this decision, but if there is no appeal, the footage will be released." And the Ramapo tribe has been told by the town to dismantle their pipeline protest camp in this story by Alex Hammer in Indian Country Today, as found in the Earth First Newswire. The New Jersey town of Mahwah, probably an Indian name, has issued an ultimatum to the Ramapo Lenape Nation, ordering the tribe to take down the teepees it has assembled on its land in opposition to the Pilgrim Pipeline, which would bring Bakken crude from Albany to refineries in southern New Jersey. The town has ordered the tribe to immediately remove any and all structures located on the property that were constructed in violation of the township's zoning ordinance, WPOX News reported on May 12th. Tribal members have been opposing the 178-mile-long pipeline with the Split Rock Sweetwater Prayer Camp since October of 2016 on 13 acres of Ramapo land within Mahwah. But rather than earn the type of support that poured in for Standing Rock Sioux Tribe against the Dakota Access Pipeline, the Ramapo have garnered the ire of the surrounding community, even though NBC News reported in December the town also opposes the Pilgrim Pipeline. The tribe has been holding ceremonies on this land for 25 years and has inhabited it for centuries. Inspired to stand with Standing Rock and make their own environmental concerns be known, the Ramapo erected a teepee on their land in the fall of 2016. This alarmed the surrounding community. In December of 2016, the township served the Ramapo with a summons stating that they had failed to obtain permits for a permanent structure. The tribe applied for the proper permits, but in April their application was denied by Township Engineer Mike Kelly. The town gave the Ramapo 60 days to refile their applications. What started as a prayer camp to peacefully protest these pipelines has now turned into a fight for survival on our own land, Ramapo Chief Dwayne Perry told ICMN in December. Nevertheless, the pipeline battle is also aiding in the fight, uniting tribal members in a way that has not happened in decades, the New York Times reported in April. On one side is Thomas Williams, the attorney for the Ramapo, who said the rights of assembly are protected under the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, a federal law protecting individuals, houses of worship, and other religious institutions from discrimination in zoning laws. On the other are neighbors of the Ramapo's Split Rock Sweetwater Prayer Camp, who have been less than friendly, according to Perry. For instance, Perry told Indian Country Media Network, "People have filmed tribal ceremonies from across the road leaving when approached. Recently, someone erected no parking signs in front of the camp's roadside property." Ramapo tribal member Two Clouds said that when he asked the man putting up the signs what he was doing, the man said he had been contracted by Ramapo Hunt and Polo Association, the homeowners association, in the high-income neighborhood the camp sits in. The Ramapo Hunt and Polo Association did not return calls to ICMN for comment. The president of that association is Paul Cyan, who also belongs to the American Association of Petroleum Geologists. While the Pilgrim Pipeline is the Ramapo's main concern, the tribe's first fight seems to be against their community that surrounds them and the township they are surrounded by. Pilgrim Pipeline is not just opposed by the Ramapo. From New York to New Jersey, townships and municipalities have also signed resolutions opposing the project. A list can be found with the Coalition Against Pilgrim Pipeline. Pilgrim Pipeline Holdings, LLC, has submitted for a preliminary draft of an environmental impact statement with the New York State Department of Conservation. The pipeline is being funded by Ares Management, LP. The tribe is calling for help and support. Please come and share as much light as possible, because the one thing that integrity, honesty, and democracy demands is light, Perry said. As long as some of our neighbors and others can operate in the dark, we are all in trouble. And the Trump budget axes Alaska's Sea Grant program. The proposed U.S. federal budget would cancel a program that provides support to coastal Alaskan communities with everything from monitoring shoreline erosion to maintaining healthy ecosystems. Nome, Alaska is a coastal town located in the western Seward Peninsula, a short jaunt from the Russian border, were it not for roughly 150 miles of ocean that divide the two. With a population of fewer than 4,000, Nome is known as the endpoint of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race, when it's known at all. Life here largely revolves around the sea. Maritime subsistence hunters patrol the surrounding icy waters for seals, walrus, whales, shorebird, fish, and invertebrates. Anything you do out there that affects marine wildlife isn't just a conservation issue, it's a food security and public health issue, said Gay Sheffield, who serves as Nome's Marine Advisory Extension Agent under the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Sea Grant Program. With few federal representatives located so far north, Sheffield points to the Post Office, Weather Service, Park Service, and one Fish and Wildlife Service law enforcement agent as her only federal peers in Nome, and she acts as the key communications facilitator for the entire Bering Strait region. That means passing on questions, comments, and observations from Alaskan natives to federal agencies located elsewhere in the state and country, and participating in collaborative research projects. More than 70% of Alaska's 730,000 residents live along its coastline. Under the Alaska Sea Grant Program, 12 Marine Advisory Extension agents serve these remote communities, with further funding funneled into research projects and marine education programs on everything from whale-watching economy to providing quality assurance for seal oil products. Sea Grant is a mixture of problem-solving around coastal community needs and building capacity in our state for supporting students and graduate students to be scientists of the future by having them involved in real-life current research projects, said Paula Cullenberg, director of Alaska Sea Grant. National priorities include sustainable fisheries, healthy coastal ecosystems, and resilient economies and communities. Our Sea Grant program doesn't look like the one you would see in Louisiana or Southern California, Cullenberg added. We don't have a lot of invasive species in this state or huge waterfront developments, but we have a lot of unique problems. Alaskans are so deeply involved in the natural environment that it would be very difficult to find an Alaskan who doesn't have some kind of wild food in their freezer or on the shelf. The connection that Alaskans have to the marine and coastal environment cannot be underestimated. But under the Trump administration's Sea Grant, which celebrated its 50th anniversary just last year, may not see another sunrise. Last Tuesday, President Donald Trump released his first full budget of the 2018 fiscal year, following his skinny budget that made the rounds this March. In that budget, Trump crossed out 40% of Sea Grant funding for the 2017 fiscal year currently underway, dooming many programs to end as early as this summer. The program was granted a temporary pardon under Congress until September 30th, but it may not survive the axe a second time, with Trump planning on cutting the program entirely as of October 1st. That means scientists such as Sheffield, the Arctic's most northernmost agent, could soon be out of work. The Sea Grant model works really well in our state. We don't get a huge amount of federal funds, but we are able to leverage those funds with University of Alaska Fairbanks dollars, said Cullenberg. But if we don't have the core funding, I don't think that we would have a program that's a skeleton that you could build off of. And border walls pose many big challenges to biodiversity, but smaller ones to humans. With the prospect of the U.S.-Mexico border wall looming, research and reporting on the ecological impacts of walls is both important and timely. reporting in Bioscience on Such Barriers, Known Effects on Wildlife, science journalist Leslie Evans Ogden describes the potential effects of the proposed structure on the 2,000-mile U.S.-Mexico border. If the wall is completed, it will create a considerable biodiversity conservation challenge, one unlikely to disappear anytime soon, she writes. The threats proposed to local populations of species may be dire. Smaller aggregations of animals are often ephemeral and rely on individuals moving between populations to replenish their numbers and genetic stocks. Local populations blink on and off like Christmas lights, says the University of Arizona's Aaron Flesch, who was interviewed for the article. The concern is that if a border wall prevents migration, isolated local populations may fail to blink back on again. Research described in the article points to problems even in areas where actions have been taken to allow animal movement. Even when there isn't a physical wall or much of a barrier, border agents are actively engaged in enforcing the law through patrols, said David Christiansen of the University of Arizona. These patrols, which may disrupt movement of other animal animal behavior, often include off-road travel right in the middle of this endangered species habitat, said Christiansen. Preliminary radio collar and camera trap data indicate that some species, such as pronghorn antelope, do not frequently travel near the U.S.-Mexico border. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org at 9 p.m. You can hear a rebroadcast of this show during Environment Friday tomorrow at 3 p.m. You could also tune into WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Friday at 5:30 p.m. KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m. WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. And the following stations, KHCF, KGIG, KPHD, and Berkeley Liberation Radio, all carry the Earth First Update on their schedule. Contact those stations for the date and time. You can always listen to RadioForAll.net, where you can listen online or download this or any previous show of the Earth First Update. That's radio, the number 4, all.net. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and produced at Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.